Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
Now I understand it to be a huge part of my drive. Like you said, right? Like, okay, well, if I accomplish this, if I excel at this level, then I will prove to myself and prove to the world that I am in fact enough. So after years of therapy, I don't know if I can precisely answer your question when it began. And maybe it does go back to childhood feeling like academically I wasn't enough. I always felt like I wasn't tall enough. I wasn't smart enough. And so I wasn't athletic enough. And so I guess perhaps proving my value in other ways came something that I was to some extent relentless about.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Kimmy, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
I'm very excited to be here.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. And, you know, I was thinking about, you know, why I said yes to you as a guest. And, you know, I was just telling you before we hit record here that it's always based on personal curiosity. And I just, you know, from reading your bio and kind of the way that your publicist had positioned you, I thought, yeah, this is a woman who sounds a lot like me in terms of the way she likes to tell stories. And so I thought, yeah, this is a no-brainer. This is somebody I want to talk to. But before we get into all that, I wanted to start by asking you, what did your parents do for work? And how did that end up shaping the choices that you made with your own life and career?
Well, my mom, when she married my dad and had my sister and me, didn't have a college degree. So when she was raising us, she went back to school and got a master's in clinical social work. And she was a social worker while we were growing up. And she was actually, you know, during a stretch working in women's shelters, working with women, doing self-esteem workshops for women who had been abused and were rebuilding their lives. So looking back, pretty fascinating, important modeling as a young girl. And my father was a serial entrepreneur and creative. He's 82, but I think he'd be great on this podcast. So I had a father who was an entrepreneur and a mother who was a social worker.
Mm-hmm. What did they teach you about making your way in the world?
Oh, I think my parents were valued kindness, right? To some extent, above performance or excellence, which is interesting because I think, you know, now in life as somebody who's really ambitious, I value all, you know, all of those things, but definitely kindness and sort of being polite was a big deal in our house. But when it came to work ethic, I think it was demonstrated in the way they lived their life. So that was a big deal in our house, was working hard and doing your best. And I didn't have a traditional brain, meaning I had a learning disability, now called learning difference. And so I think I saw, in particular, my dad developing strengths that compensated for the pieces of him that you know were different or perceived as weak, and my creative life and professional life sort of played out in the same way.
Mm-hmm. Did they encourage any particular career paths based on their own experience? Because, you know, I mean, as the joke goes for Indian people, it's doctor, lawyer, engineer. If you want a good life, that's pretty much it. Like our future is limited to three options by the time we're 15.
You know, I knew, oddly, because I feel like most people don't decide what they want to do and actually end up having that be their career path. But by the time I was 14, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to tell stories, and I wanted to tell stories about real people. I couldn't articulate it that way, but I was writing for the school newspaper. I was obsessed with photography. If I was asked to do a research paper, I would, you know, convince that I should do a presentation with photography and video to tell the narrative. And I think for the most part, they sort of stood back and let us do our thing. So I don't ever remember feeling like, you know, there's only one path to success, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to dive deeper into this idea of not having a typical brain as a fellow non-neurotypical person. I had a 4-3 teacher, and I wrote about an article about this recently, about the long and short term consequences of being undiagnosed with ADHD. And I had Jesse Patel, the founder of Workflowy, here. And by the time he was 13, I think he said he had been kicked out of multiple schools and it was just kind of the bad kid. And his dad happened to be a physician and was like, I think you have ADD. Do you want to take something for it? And he goes from being the kid who's been kicked out of multiple schools to getting into Stanford and realizing that, wait a minute, I am smart. My brain just works differently. And when my 4th grade teacher and all of the things I could have been failing, I was failing reading, which is really ironic considering what I've done for a living. But you know, like when you figured this out, what was the sort of response from your parents? And more importantly, like, why is it that, you know, we leave so many people behind when it comes to this? Because I feel like our school system fails people who are not neurotypical.
It's so true. Like the notion that somehow all our brains work the same, right? We're all sitting in a class looking forward and everyone's brain works the same. It's like, when you think about it, it's ridiculous. So I was never diagnosed, and this is fascinating. So I have three kids, and my middle daughter, for good or for bad, is a lot like me. And it was when we were trying to figure out her brain and how she learns, and they diagnosed her with a visual processing disorder, and they were explaining to me how to use a word window because the, you know, just seeing all the black and white on a page is jumbled. And the word window highlights line by line. To this day, I cannot read a book. I can't do it. My brain can't decode it. I am constantly consuming audiobooks, never not immersed in a book. And when I saw the lines highlighted, I was like, oh my gosh, like I could have been able to read had it been presented to me in this way. And so I was never diagnosed until I diagnosed my daughter and realized that, you know, there would have been, so all the modalities we taught her and I learned to teach her just completely lit up my brain, like, but not until I was in my 40s.
Mm-hmm. I can relate. You know, I wasn't diagnosed until I was 28, I think, if I remember correctly. And I think it was not a coincidence that after I got diagnosed, I remember calling a friend. I was like, what would you say if I told you that I might have ADHD? He said, I wouldn't be surprised at all. He said, you know, when you come to visit, it's like a tornado has been through my house. I find stuff left behind for months. But, you know, like, I contrast that story with Jesse Patel, and I'm just like, wow, I always wonder. I remember the reason I wrote that article is I was talking to one of my readers, and we both kind of joked about the fact that, you know, can you imagine what we would have accomplished if somebody had actually figured this out sooner?
I mean, I think, you know, it's so interesting because I've gone back. I didn't do well academically. I was mostly a C student at best. But I think I compensated. I wanted to participate. I wanted to be contributing, be doing well, be doing interesting things, but I just couldn't pull it off academically at all. So I leaned into all these other things. I was starting clubs. I was, you know, doing photography with the school newspaper. And so I've had the same question that you had, like, okay, well, what if I had figured it out? But I wonder if I had figured it out, if I wouldn't leaned into all of those aspects that developed for me, like creatively and as a leader. So it's interesting because I think sometimes our perceived, setbacks foster other strengths within us.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I think that somebody had asked me once, why did you end up going down this path? I was like, a lot of people have this moment of disillusionment after they climb the corporate ladder or whatever. I was like, that's not my story. Like, I started this path because I didn't have any other alternative.
Yeah.
Like, I had no other way to do this. So one thing I think that really struck me was that you said you knew at 14 what you wanted to do. And, we're talking earlier about sort of career paths and, the Indian parent narrative of, doctor, lawyer, engineer. And I feel like in one way, our school system perpetuates this sort of, you need to know what you want to do with your life narrative. And I always say, how the hell can you know what you want to do with your life when you've only lived a fraction of it? Yet you seem to be like one of those rare few who kind of knew this early. And my sister was like that. She knew, I think at age 7, she's like, I'm going to be a doctor. And she knew it. And I feel like so many people commit to paths they know nothing about, only to wake up one day and realize they hate the life they've built for themselves.
Well, it's still fascinating to me that because I've grown so much as a person, and I look back at that time in my life and, not to say I was pretty broken. I mean, I think most, that's a tricky, tough age, right? Sort of early teen adulting.
That's an understatement. That's like the part of life that you hope to never revisit again. Nothing sucks more than being a teenager, in my opinion.
Nothing sucks more than being a teenager, but I don't look back on being a teenager and remember, feeling very confident in myself, sure about my path ahead. But I did stumble upon this thing I love, and going back to, what we've talked about a few times now, this different, unique brain, is how it all played out is, I was asked to do at the time the HIV and AIDS crisis was, exploding, and there was a lot of narrative around it. So I was asked to do a report in one of my classes. So I went to my teacher and said, instead of doing a traditional research report, I want to go out and interview people. So I actually went out and interviewed people, living with HIV and AIDS. And it took the video, showed the video and talked about it in front of my class. And I was so, looking back, felt so alive in that process. Like you said at the beginning, I just realized my innate curiosity about human beings and understanding them. And now it makes even more sense, my innate curiosity about understanding human beings suffering and enduring and what that looks like. And so I literally think it was that specific project. Subconsciously, it was like, okay, this is what I want to do. So all these years later, still telling stories, and I've done it in lots of different ways.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Well, you mentioned you have three parents and or three kids, I'm sorry. And if you had to create a system that allowed for people to discover that when they were young, what would you change about the way that we educate people so that they would have the experiences you have? Because me getting here was largely accidental, and that has its pros and cons. Like Robert Greene once said to me, he's like, no experience in your life should be thought of as wasted. And there's definitely a grain of truth to that. I see now that all the things that I've done have led me to where I'm at. And yet there's this part of me that says, you know what? If somebody had figured this out sooner, you know, I wouldn't have spent 10 years of my life getting fired from every damn job I ever had.
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to this idea of diversity, right? And I always felt lesser than, not enough in academic settings. You know, still, even in my professional life, I would, you know, find myself being part of a team and everyone's like, oh, I went to Brown. I went to Stanford. It's like, well, barely made it through Boulder. But this, now I know myself to be a really intelligent person. And I think this idea that there's lots of different ways to learn and there's lots of different ways to contribute to the world with your mind and with your intelligence. So I think people learn through travel. People learn through food. People learn through intimate conversations. People learn through books. And there isn't only one path. So I think if there was an opportunity to see, where do you feel lit up? Where does your brain and your heart feel lit up? So let's dive into that as a process of learning would have been, you know, in my case, I think I was trying to find those paths through photography, through interviewing. But like, what if that was an option for all of us to explore how we learn and have opportunities to learn and to grow and explore, you know, within those ways? So I don't, you know, I have not worked out in the 2 minutes I share that with you how that would be feasible, but I think it would
sure
be pretty incredible.
I'm in the middle of Matthew Perry's new biography, and he's talking about fame. And it's funny because you hear this over and over and over from famous people. It's like fame doesn't heal the wounds that you think it will. And the only people who understand that are people who are famous, and people who are not just can't comprehend that idea. They think that being famous will solve all their problems.
Well, I mean, I think like I'm not, this is not unique to me, but my narrative of not enough started at a really young age. And I was for many years convinced that I would be enough if I, you know, my pursuits were always creative pursuit. Sorry, my pursuit. My pursuits were always creative pursuits, but that if I got into Sundance, then I would be enough, right? This would be incredible. Then I would have fulfillment. And again, the fulfillment, it was elusive. It never came. And that lesson takes time, but is in a bizarre sense, you know, comforting and freeing when you realize that truth.
I can relate. I think in my head, it was always, oh, my parents won't think I'm just screwing around the internet when I get a book deal, when I do this. You know, it's like Wall Street Journal bestselling book that was self-published. Nope, didn't do it. Book deal with a publisher, didn't do it. You know, the round of venture funding, nope, I'm still insecure about this. So it just blows my mind that I've been at this for 10 years and I still have questions about this. And I don't think I've resolved this yet for myself. But that feeling of not enough, like, where did that come from for you? How did you begin to unwind the narrative? And how do other people identify where it came from? And more importantly, begin to unwind that narrative?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty much, I would imagine, a very shared human emotion, this notion of not enough. But I feel like I've been particularly gifted or plagued with it. And the interesting thing about that is it has always, now I understand it to be a huge part of my drive. Like you said, right? Like, okay, well, if I accomplish this, if I excel at this level, then I will prove to myself and prove to the world that I am in fact enough. So after years of therapy, I don't know if I can precisely answer your question when it began. And maybe it does go back to childhood feeling like, you know, academically, I wasn't enough. I always felt like I wasn't tall enough. I wasn't smart enough. And so I guess perhaps I wasn't athletic enough. So proving my value in other ways came something that I was, to some extent, relentless about.
I think it's fascinating because you talked about how it's part of your drive, and I think we both have that in common. I always tell people, it's like, I don't care about growing an audience for the size of the audience. It's not about that. It's about, one, just proving to myself that I can do it and having some sort of impact on the world and having the ability to shape and influence culture. Like, it's all these other things, but you're right. There is a part of it that is absolutely driven by this need, the sense that I'm not enough in some way or another, not enough for my parents, not enough for some girl that I want to date, not enough for anybody. And as I'm reading this Matthew Perry book, I keep thinking to myself, like, here's a guy who has spent his whole life feeling like he's not enough. And the dark side of it is it drove him to drugs and alcohol. But I think that achievement can be in its own kind of addiction. And I remember I felt this. I wrote an article about this. I had a friend who told me, he's like, I think you're addicted to achievement. And I never saw that as a bad thing. I mean, I come from the Indian culture. It's like ambition is not frowned upon. But there's this darker side to it that I don't think we ever acknowledge. This is where I'm going with this. Like, how do you find that balance between fulfillment and ambition?
Well, it's such a good question because I genuinely feel fulfilled by my work. I feel like it's aligned with my intentions, right? I want to make a positive dent. I want to create meaningful work that ignites people or inspires people to think differently about themselves, about each other. So when I lean into that piece of it versus, if the podcast grew to this level, or, well, if, you know, the film had won this award. So it's, I don't know, maybe it's like small brain, big brain. Like, when I'm not thinking in that smaller way, and I can actually let it sink in that this work matters and it's aligned with my values and what I want to contribute to the world. But to be honest, like, I have to work for that, because I can live in the place of, well, if only I achieve, or if my audience was this size, then it would be. So that's not an easy cognitive process for me. I think vacillate in the wrong direction.
You and I both. I mean, I can relate. This is why I have to basically stopped using social media. Like I had to put in all these mechanisms. My friends like, you don't check the sales of your books or your rankings. I was like, no, because that's a recipe for anxiety and disappointment, because it just leads to endless comparison. It's like, oh, why is my friend Ryan Holiday selling a million books? I'm like, because he's a better writer, obviously, which he is, you know, like I'm not denying that, you know, to me, I've made my peace with the fact that I'm not going to be any of those people. Like it's taken me a long time to come to terms with the fact that I will never be able to write in the way that many of my guests do. They're better at certain things, and most of them probably couldn't host this show.
Yeah. And it's, you know, like I've been very project based in my, I obviously for a while worked with, you know, networks and media companies, but then I think I've found my rhythm and flow independently doing creative projects. But every time, and these are projects that take years and years and days and hours, show up. Every time when it's over, I wake up and immediately it's what's next? What am I versus, you know, as we said, just sort of letting it all sink in, the process, the contribution. Instead, it's this relentless pursuit of what can I do next to prove to myself, you know,
that you're enough.
The enoughness. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, speaking of work, you alluded to the fact that you were at Boulder. I don't know if you knew this. I actually lived in Boulder for 2.5 years. So, but what was the trajectory that led you down to doing all this media work?
So I was a journalism major at Boulder, always focused on visual. So, you know, photography, and video. And I was about to graduate. My professor had been one of the, I guess, earlier founding producers at CNN when CNN was brand new and based in Atlanta. And I was sitting in her class and she came in and said, there is a story breaking in Colorado. They think it's a hostage situation, but the national media is flying out, and CNN called and asked if I could, you know, bring some students to get there as soon as possible. So I hopped in the car with my professor and we went and arrived at Columbine High School, which was, you know, one of the obviously largest massacres and school shooting in the country, certainly at that time. And we were one of the first to arrive. So I found myself, you know, on the lawn with families, sitting there with them, you know, relaying information. And eventually the, you know, real journalists, quote unquote, came from all over the world. And they hired us as interns. I don't think hired is the right word. I think we stayed and they gave us somewhere to sleep and food. And, you know, from there I stayed. And at the end they said, you know, if you want a desk assistant, you know, position in New York or DC, you know, we can try and help you get there, because I'd been working really hard for weeks on end with them. And that was the beginning.
Hmm. Well, so as somebody who has had such a, you know, front row seat to media, this is something that I wonder about in our sort of world in which misinformation spreads and has serious consequences. And we have this fragmented media landscape with multiple versions of the truth. What do you think is the responsibility of people who create media in the world that we live in today?
Well, I feel like then there was so much more integrity in journalism, because it wasn't, there was a point in which I walked away from, in particular, working in news, because it was almost as if conflict and tension started to sell, right? There was this notion that if you create tension, it was when pundits came in. But before that, it was reporting in a responsible and fair matter as a service to inform the country and the world factually, to stand witness to it, right? And that became, I think, with 24-hour news and like social media, it just has spun out of control. And so talking about alignment with integrity, and I think if you're going to work exhausting hours to create content to put in the world, you better be damn well sure you feel good about that content. And I think traditional media, when it went in the direction of more opinion and tension versus observation and facts, was no longer aligned for me. And I think that's the landscape we're looking at today, sadly. I hope the pendulum swings in the other direction, because it's really confusing as, you know, consumers of media about what's true and what's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, I mean, as you were saying that, I couldn't help but think of the show, The Loudest Voice in the Room, on Amazon. I don't know if you've seen that. It's the show about how Fox News was built.
Uh-huh.
And there is this scene, Russell Crowe plays Roger Ailes, where he talks about creating media in such a way that people will never change the channel.
Yeah.
And you know, as a podcast host, naturally, like I think about that, and I actually went and read all of Roger Ailes' books. Like people are like, "What's wrong with you? Like he stands for everything that you're against." I was like, "Yes, but
I need to understand it." Yes, I need to understand.
Yeah, no, my attitude towards things like that has always been: I will not write off the value of a message because I don't agree with the messenger, or because I don't like the messenger. And you know, as an example, recently I had we did an entire series on cults. And we had a Nexium member. And a few days ago, a Nexium member who actually had a positive Nexium experience emailed me. And he was like, "Would you be willing to have me on the show?" And I said, "Yeah, absolutely. Because I do want to hear the other side of the story."
Yeah.
My side of the story that I've told has been the awful side. But here's a guy who had Tourette's cured. And he said that his story wasn't given enough visibility. And he said, "I know you're nuanced about your conversations. And I'm thinking you'll be open-minded enough to hear the story." I was like, "I'm absolutely open-minded enough. I don't necessarily think it would make Keith Raniere a hero in my eyes, but I want to hear what this guy's experience was."
Yeah. Well, like it informs you in a deeper, richer, and you know, of all the perspectives. So you can be more informed, you know, for your truth. And so yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Well, I mean, I know from your background that you went from that to, I don't know if there's something in between, but I know you went to go work for Oprah.
Yeah.
Correct? Mm-hmm.
I did.
I mean, obviously that's quite a contrast from like, you know, news to Oprah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was, you know, I often talk about this, well, since we're talking about Oprah, I'll call it an aha moment because she coined that phrase, right? But this sort of light bulb moment where I went to work for Oprah. I was based on the West Coast, but I was flying back and forth to Chicago. We were developing story ideas. I was initially brought in on the story development team, which means like stare at a whiteboard and come up with ideas of what shows and guests and can be. And we're pitching ideas. And one of the bosses says, which is sort of this, you know, I'm new to the show and the culture. What is your intention in telling that story? And I was like, oh my, I have never been asked that. I have never been asked that. And I had worked for the major networks, told stories, you know, for that went out to millions of people on a daily basis. And that pause of, well, what is the intention? What do you want people to feel? What do you want people to? And so that was like mind blowing for me. And, you know, now it seems so obvious, but I was relatively young and just that pause of thinking through the intention was like, why is this the first time, you know, that I've been asked that or that I didn't come up with, you know, I didn't get that connection on my own. So, yeah, I mean, it was pretty incredible experience. Obviously, there was unlimited budgets, lots of, you know, big dreams that were executable with a lot of support, you know, big visions for, you know, crazy things that we pulled off. And it was fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reason I wanted to talk about that is I feel like so many people, particularly in the spaces that you and I play in, Oprah is kind of the gold standard by which they measure themselves by, where it's like, I remember hearing a podcast host tell me they wanted to become the next Oprah. And you may have heard it. WBEZ in Chicago did this, podcast on the making of Oprah. And the thing that stood out to me most about the entire series was one thing that they said. They said that today's media landscape does not allow for another Oprah to be created. It's simply not possible in such a fragmented media landscape. And I thought to myself, well, yeah, that would make trying to become the next Oprah a stupid goal, which is already a stupid goal because you're not that person. But the thing I guess I wonder is when we look at outliers, like I wrote this other piece titled Why Outliers Are Actually Lousy Role Models for Most of Us, because we don't see the sides of the story that we can't replicate. We only see the good things. And there's a lot of survivorship bias and a whole other host of cognitive biases in these stories. Which is, I think, one of the reasons to me, like what I'm trying to do is find relatable models of possibility. And that was the one thing, you know, I saw with Oprah and over and over again, because I've had some guests that have been on Oprah as well. And I thought to myself, like, some of these people are so far removed from where the average person is at, that they're not able to, they're inspiring, but not relatable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how do we use people like this as a role model without having unrealistic expectations and letting our ambition take us, you know, down this dark hole of not feeling like we're enough? Because if you've got to be Oprah to feel like you're enough, well, I mean, that's going to be a lifetime of feeling like you're not enough.
Yeah. I mean, ideally, we, you know, move closer to seeing our own value as unique beings. And you're right, like the notion of success being that you are someone else, you know, when you break it down, clearly doesn't make a lot of sense. So, I mean, I think another way to think about it or approach it would be to figure out the pieces of that person. So maybe it's one aspect of that person. I really value how she can own her spirituality and talk about that in a way that's unfiltered and real. Or I really value the way that she uses media and content to illuminate issues, or, you know, how she merged philanthropy and cause and story. So maybe versus saying, I want to be like this, like, getting really intentional and specific about your aspirations about that person. Well, what does that reflect in me that I value? I think that seems like a smarter path if we're looking at you know, big role models in society, is what specifically, you know, and you know, how can you look at that as a bit of a guidepost or a North Star to say, I want to grow in that way because it's really appealing for me and really aligned for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, I mean, the thing that I think strikes me most is one, Oprah herself, but even the guests on there. I mean, these people are at the top of their game in every way. And I mean, I'm guessing much like myself, you probably recognize patterns. I mean, I think pattern recognition is an, you know, inevitable consequence of doing this kind of work. You have 1,000 conversations with people from every walk of life, you start to notice patterns. What about you? Like, what were the patterns that you noticed that enable these people to do what they do at the level they do it?
I mean, I think they all have teams around them. So I think the illusion that they're somehow superheroes.
Superhuman.
Yeah. And superhumans is categorically false. I think there are all, I keep using the word alignment. Who you see is not always aligned with, you know, there was many guests that are really well-known household names around the world who, when the camera's on, are very different than when the camera's off. Right. So I think that, alone, but I think they surround themselves with smart, hardworking people. I think they all are relentless in their pursuits. They work incredibly hard at what they do in their craft. So I think there's a huge amount of commitment and dedication, and then surrounding themselves with smart, capable people who share in their vision of success and contribution.
Going back to this team of enough, did you ever feel like you noticed that any of them are driven by a sense that they're not enough?
Oh, 100%. 100%. I mean, the amount of, you know, insecurities and humanness, right? The idea that somehow these people aren't human. But it was actually, I think, in an article that Oprah said, or I don't know, maybe she said it at like a team or company meeting. But this idea that she had interviewed people, you know, from kindergartners to presidents, and almost everyone on that stage said the same thing after, which was, did I do okay? Or was that all right? You know, at the ending of the interview. And, you know, I mean, from having guests on your podcast, or how you feel when you're interviewed, I always get the email after and I'm like, was that all right? Did I do? And it's just, it's freaking universal.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's fascinating to me that you talked about the idea that, you know, who we see when the cameras are rolling are not the people we see when they're not. And like, I've been on a reality TV show, and it's funny. Kel Newport was joking. She was like, so we didn't get authentic Srini. I was like, no, you got Srini, who is mindful of the fact that he's a public figure. And if he looks like an idiot in front of a million people, it's going to matter.
Yeah. Duh. Yes. It's so true.
Yeah. Well, because I think there's this idea that, you know, I had this conversation with Tim John, and he titled the episode, We Don't Want 100% Authenticity. With this author named Steve Goldstein here, who actually worked on the Oprah team for a while too. And he wrote this book. I don't remember the exact title. I remember the subtitle. It's about how the most powerful people from, Washington to Hollywood to Wall Street get us to like them. And one of the things that he talked about was this idea of authenticity and how it's so misunderstood. Because I realized, I was like, the audience doesn't give a damn about your problems. They want you to solve theirs. And you don't, this is another thing. I had a mentor once. This was right after a really bad breakup, and I was just going out the deep end. And, you know, when you have a public presence and you're broadcasting your bullshit, that's not good for business. And I remember telling him, yeah, Greg, but I'm human too. And his response was, yes, Trini, you don't get to make that excuse.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was harsh, but you know what? He was right.
Yeah. That's a powerful statement. You don't get, I love that.
You don't. Yeah. You don't get to make that excuse. When you're in the public eye, your personal life is basically not of, you know, any concern to the public. Yeah. And you have to basically separate the two, no matter how screwed up you feel about something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it just makes me think, like, we don't see what's really going on behind the microphones, behind the cameras, or any of the things in these people's lives.
So true. So true.
What are the darker sides of these people that we don't see? The things that might surprise us?
The darker sides. I mean, I think that, like all of us, there is a diversity of personality and ways of being. And it was really illuminating to what you just said to see the truth of that, right? So there was, I'll talk about Forrest Whitaker for an example. I think I'm okay highlighting the positives. I interviewed Forrest Whitaker a few times while I was working for Oprah. And Forrest Whitaker was the type of person who, while he was sitting down and we were adjusting the lighting and the audio and getting everything, genuinely cared and was curious about the people in the room. So you would find him, you know, chatting with the sound engineer about, do you have kids? Do you have, engaging in such a real and kind and connected and meaningful way. There were people who were horrendous. I mean, the entitlement, the, to, you know, when no one was looking, when the cameras are off. So I think that was just totally fascinating to see, especially because you got to see like the juxtaposition, the comparison. You're like, holy shit, this person was just such an asshole, and cameras on. It was like, boom, game on, let's do this, and smile and charm. So I got to literally be a fly on the wall. And at the time we were interviewing, you know, rock stars and astronauts and, you know, actors and athletes and all of these. And you just got to see their humanness, like for good or for bad. And that is super interesting. And you talked about social media and like perceptions there. I do think it's given me a pretty, like a filter of like, I truly understand that what you see is not reality. I truly, truly understand that.
Wow. Well, you know, I'm glad you brought up the word entitlement, because there was something I wanted to go back to that you had mentioned at the earlier part of our conversation. And that was that your mother was a social worker.
Yeah.
And something that I think I've become aware of over the last probably 2 or 3 years is that the conversations that I have with people on this show are relevant to people who are in a position of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And often I feel like when we look at sort of self-improvement or any of these sort of spiritual efforts, they largely are catered towards an audience of privileged people. Even though we don't want to admit that, it makes us seem like assholes. But the truth is, like, I mean, you know, from what you're telling me and based on my background, we grew up in relatively privileged circumstances.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So with that in mind, what did your mother teach you about privilege and, you know, sort of your status in society? And what have you taught your kids about that?
I mean, I went back to when you asked me about my childhood and what was important in our house. And I brought up kindness, which sounds kind of hokey, right? Or I guess now it's not as undervalued, but I know that I grew up with parents who were just, kind and respectful to people in the world. You know, obviously we all have our moments, but I think this idea of, you know, how we act when no one's looking and, you know, how we treat people as we move through the world, especially when those people really don't have anything to offer us for lack of a better word. But, you know, there's lots of people who are nice to people they want to or need to be nice to, but aren't generally nice to the waitress or the checkout person. And I think my parents really modeled those small acts on a daily and micro basis that build up your character and who you are. And so I think for my kids, I have modeled that as well. I like to believe that they are kind and respectful to almost everyone they encounter.
So, I mean, you've gotten to do things that I think a lot of people dream about doing. I mean, getting to work with iconic creatives like Oprah, getting to produce things that millions of people have seen, write books that hundreds of thousands of people have read. You know, going back to this whole theme of feeling like you're enough, how has your personal definition of what it means to be successful changed with time and with age?
I think living in a very authentic way, we didn't get into it with childhood, but a big part of my father's perpetual entrepreneurship was that he was undiagnosed bipolar, had bipolar disorder and was undiagnosed until he was 50. So I grew up with a very manic and a very depressive father. And he hit it once he was diagnosed, and then it's hereditary. So I have bipolar disorder and hit it until about 3 or 4 years ago when I shared the diagnosis and the story of what it means to live with bipolar disorder on my podcast. And I feel like it has played a big part in the art in both film and television and books and now the podcast. And I don't know how to explain it other than it felt like this very dark secret that was actually fueling a lot of the work that I was doing. I think it, the depression sort of fuels my compassion and empathy, which shows up in the work a lot. Sometimes the mania drives the productivity. And so there was something about the sharing of that. Like once I was super transparent and honest with myself and the world about that, that the work, it sort of clicked for me. And I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. But, and it, naturally, of course, it raises more. I guess two questions, you know, one, when it comes to bipolar disorder, what's the difference between sort of the reality versus the perception that we experience through media, through books we read? And I can relate to that having gone through periods of depression in my life. I mean, I remember when I just crashed and burned after a breakup in 2014. A doctor's like, you've had long-term low-grade clinical depression that went undiagnosed. And she's like, and you just went from a series of extreme highs, which was like the year that, you know, like my life looked like it was taking off to, you know, a sudden series of extreme lows. So everything just went to shit. And it just didn't get better for 6 months, like to the point where I almost ran my business into the ground. But I also came out of the other side of that realizing that, okay, you know, people who have these issues are not crazy. And that this is very real.
Well, I did a podcast episode called Kimmy Is Not Carrie from Homeland. And I don't know if you watched Homeland, but, I know this episode will most likely air later, but right now, Elon Musk and Ye, formerly known as Kanye West, are both in the news. And there is a lot of discussion about both of them being manic depressive, living with bipolar disorder. So that is showing up in really damaging, deeply damaging, negative ways. And so I think it's interesting to observe when you have a shared diagnosis, right? And you see, the negative implosion and the ramifications to almost feel like, no, but that's not me. I don't want to share a label, right? I don't want people to think that that is who I'm going to be because we share a diagnosis and we share a label. So I think the portrayals are often public figures. They're often very not exaggerated because they are what they are. But for other people living quietly with the illness, it's yet another reason you don't want to raise your hand and say, oh, me too. I'm also living with this, because the perception is quickly going to go to, is she batshit crazy? Like, is she about to implode? I certainly live on an emotional roller coaster at times, like we all do. But I also live a meaningful life that I like most of the time. But that said, and going back to privilege, I have access to great psychiatrists. I've been on medication. I have access to great talk therapy. I have access to all sorts of modalities for self-care, like taking, you know, workout classes or being able to do acupuncture. So I have a lot of things in my favor for living with this illness.
Mm-hmm. How does it affect relationships with loved ones?
Well, I think it requires a certain amount of self-awareness for the person living with bipolar disorder, because sometimes your behavior isn't congruent with the person you want to be, right? And so I think for relationships, it requires a lot of patience. and at times I think it's exhausting to be married with, you know, or to be in a relationship, because when somebody else is on a roller coaster and you're surrounded by their energy, you're on it too, right? So, I think to be responsible in relationship, and by the way, working relationships, like I'm actually working on an article right now on being self-aware about the impact on others, because when you're emailing people, like, you know, all night long, we should do this, and this is an idea. It may be a fabulous fucking idea, but you don't need to email the person, you know, four times in the middle of the night and they wake up in their inbox. So like even self-awareness on that level. So yeah, I think it has an impact in all of your relationships. Now, I want to balance that out to say that this is episodes. So there are long stretches, again, with self-care, with medication, and with therapy, where I feel very balanced, pretty balanced in my body and in my relationships. But when there are episodes, there's an impact on all your relationships.
Wow. Well, I feel like you and I could sit here and just talk for 3 or 4 hours because there's so many rabbit holes that we could explore and places we could go with this. But in the interest of time, I want to finish with one last question, which I'm sure you've heard me ask. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think figuring out what lights you up and stepping into that with your truest self.
Amazing. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story and your wisdom and your insights with our listeners. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything that you're up to?
You can find me at kimmiculp.com. So it's KIMICULP.com. And my podcast, which is All the Wiser Podcasts, wherever you get your podcast.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here, like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that, and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.